We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
I want to get my microphone going.
There you go.
I don't know why they
Welcome
turn
back,
those
Maria.
Off.
Here I am.
All right. Lots to cover. We're going to be, we should forewarn people or let them know that we're going to be doing the overhyped and underreported stories for national and international in the second half.
Yes.
Yeah,
right.
But first, the news of the week.
That's right. Starting with local and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Yeah, this week, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals decided that Washington State's law that restricts campaign donations to less than $5,000 in the 3 weeks before an election, they decided that that was unconstitutional, that it was a limit on free speech rights, once again equating your free speech rights with how much money you can spend. I found that kind of interesting, since the idea of restricting those huge campaign contributions right before the election is to try to, try to regulate speech about a candidate or about an issue so that it isn't all dominated by whoever has the most money to spend.
Well, and also the idea behind doing those kind of donations at the last minute is to do attack ads that people can't defend themselves against because they don't have time to respond.
Right.
And so that's what that's trying to protect. So in many ways, it's also protecting free speech because it protects people from getting ground out.
Yeah, yeah. That's the idea, I think. But the court did not agree at all, although it did uphold Washington's law stating that campaigns still had to report the names of anyone or any organization who donates more than $25 to their campaign, which candidates have complained is onerous, but does give the public at least the opportunity to see who is funding these extensive campaign ads.
Yeah, although again, for the last minute donations, you don't see that information until after the election.
Until after the election,
doesn't
yeah.
help.
Yeah.
Speaking of elections, there's also a plan that came out, looks like a final plan for redistricting.
That's correct. The Redistricting Commission came out with its once every 10 years redistricting of state legislative and federal congressional districts this week.
How did that turn out?
Well, not surprisingly, because Democrats and Republicans under Washington state law have to agree. Three out of the four commissioners, two Republicans, two Democrats, have to agree on a plan. And so the plan, which was jointly devised by Republican Slade Gordon and Democrat Tim Sice, basically protected incumbents for both parties. The state of Washington will get one new congressional district owing to population gains between 2000 and 2010. That new congressional district will be situated around Olympia, the new 10th district, and that district expected to go heavily Democratic. But several other districts were rejiggered to the advantage of Republicans. The 8th district, where Dave Reichert is the incumbent, will now include Ellensburg and areas of Kittitas and Chelan County, Wenatchee, east of the mountains. And so that will make that district much more conservative and more safe for him. Similarly, the 3rd district in Southwest Washington.
He's had challenges by strong Democrats in the past. So that really was trying to consolidate that as a Republican district, right?
Yes, that was much more of a swing district, and although it always elected a Republican, but the demographics of the district were changing to become more Democratic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that acted to protect his seat. Similarly, the 3rd district, which elected a Republican for the first time in many years 2 years ago, cut off the part of the district that was that included Olympia, and so is now centered around Vancouver and Chehalis County. Or Chehalis and Lewis County, so that it's much more conservative, again protecting the Republican incumbent. And then the 1st district, which is going to be open now with Jay Inslee running for governor. That has been a somewhat Democratic district for the last number of years, centered around Snohomish County and areas of suburban Seattle. That district now actually got shifted entirely, so that it now covers much of what the old 2nd district of Rick Larson covered. It goes all the way to the Canadian border. It covers eastern Whatcom, eastern Skagit, eastern Snohomish, and northeastern King counties, so that you have a couple of the 1st district Democratic challengers, Roger Goodman and Darcy Berner, who are centered, Goodman lives in Kirkland and Berner lives in Carnation, are going to be in that district. They're still running for the first district open seat, but the district now looks very, very different and much more conservative. And so they'll be running against each other and against a Tea Party candidate who opposed Rick Larson in 2010. So again, that's more of an advantage to the incumbents because that was to the Republicans because that was expected to be more of a Democratic district. Now it's very much more of a swing district, and it's really the only district in Washington State that doesn't have a significant advantage for one or the other party.
That's interesting. It sounds to me like the Republicans got more out of this deal than the Democrats did.
Well, the Democrats got one very safe seat in Olympia, the new 10th district. But the Republicans got significant advantages compared to where they were before in three districts.
Yeah.
And in the end there, that was, wasn't that Tim Sice and Slade Gorton?
That's what I said when you weren't listening.
Oh, okay.
Tim Sice was a former assistant to Mayor Nichols, and Slade Gorton, as folks may remember, was a former U.S. senator, a Republican U.S. senator for the state of Washington.
Yeah, the Skeletor.
Yes.
And I think Sice's nickname was the Shark.
Senator yes. Fish Sticks, as some people used to call him.
Yes.
All right, let's move on, still sticking with electoral issues and signature gathering.
Yeah, New Approach Washington, the ACLU-backed organization that has been gathering signatures for a marijuana decriminalization initiative in 2012, submitted 350,000 signatures to the state Secretary of State this week, more than enough to get it on the ballot next year. But why they're doing it before the end of the year is so that the state legislature has to consider the initiative first. They can choose either in the 60-day legislative session coming up in January, they can either choose to pass it themselves or they can defer and put it on the ballot. Almost certainly they will put it on the ballot because, of course, the Democratic leadership of the House and Senate are not known for their profiles and courage. But so this almost certainly will go to the ballot next November. Now, this has been somewhat controversial among marijuana advocates and medical marijuana advocates because of the DUI provisions of this, which are really importing an alcohol model to THC, which you can have THC levels in your blood for a long, long time after you are not impaired, and after literally weeks after you've taken marijuana. And the THC levels tend to be higher in chronic users, such as medical marijuana patients, because you develop tolerance over time. And so what medical marijuana advocates are saying is that they can be pulled over and accused and convicted of DUI under this law when they're not impaired at all. So this is a concern that a lot of pot advocates have had, and we'll be hearing a lot more about this in the next year because it almost certainly will be on the ballot in 2012.
All right. Moving on, jumping over to international, starting with Iraq.
Yeah, this week, more developments in Iraq, moving more towards the government breaking up. Nuri Kamal al-Maliki, the prime minister of Iraq, he about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, issued this crackdown against the Sunni minority in the country. It was reported as an arrest warrant for his Sunni vice president, but what it actually was he had sent out a bunch of government militias to round up a whole bunch of Sunni political leaders in addition, and then issued an arrest warrant for his Sunni vice president, who by that time had heard about the crackdown and had fled to the Kurdish region of Iraq. Now this week, Maliki decided that he would go back on his coalition government. This is after Muqtada al-Sadr, the other main Shiite politician in Iraq, decided that he was going to withdraw from the coalition that he had formed with Maliki in order to govern the country. Well, Maliki needs those 40 seats in parliament in order to have a majority. And with al-Sadr gone, he no longer has a majority in parliament. So now he's saying, well, this power sharing idea is not such a great thing anymore. I think I would just like to set myself up as dictator pretty much. Those aren't the words he used, but
it's
the gist of what he said. The U.S., in the meantime, is going forward with an $11 billion aid package to provide weapons to the Iraqi government. Now, this doesn't just include F-16 fighters and tanks. It also includes light weaponry. It includes sport utility vehicles and body armor, the kinds of things that, a death squad could use in a crackdown against a minority population in the country, which is what everyone is saying Maliki will use the weaponry for.
So let me get this straight. Now, the United States invaded Iraq in order to establish a democracy in the Middle East.
Yes.
That was the story.
One of the goals, yes.
Yeah, that was the story. And so here we are entering 2012 where almost every country in the Middle East is moving toward greater democracy except Iraq.
Well, yeah.
just wanted to, clarify that.
Yeah. All right. Moving on, Syria.
Yeah, one of the countries that's moving very fitfully toward greater freedom is Syria, that had its largest demonstrations yet yesterday. Of course, Friday being the day of worship in the Muslim world and the day when protests are usually the largest. 500,000 people estimated to be protesting in Syria yesterday, and that just in Damascus. Other cities, of course, having their crowds as well. So the crackdowns have been getting bloodier with the Assad government and the Arab League with its monitors in place in Syria over the past 2 weeks, having very limited access and a very limited effect in trying to forestall the bloodshed. A lot more talk going on now about potential for foreign intervention and foreign action, but this surprisingly has gotten much less attention in terms of the potential for civilian death and the actuality of civilian death than the potential did in Libya 9 months ago, where that was mostly just the potential that Gaddafi was talking about for massacring citizens. These massacres are now actually taking place in Syria, and the international community pretty much just standing by at this point, but there's going to be more and more calls, I think, for some sort of intervention as the situation continues to escalate.
All right. And Yemen.
Yeah, the grand leader of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, was given permission to get medical treatment in the United States this week while we support his sons who are still trying to rule the country there against the various democracy movements in place there, as well as Islamist movements and secession movements, and it's really quite a chaotic mess in Yemen right now. But because of the presence of Al-Qaeda in Yemen, the United States has been very much four square behind the Saleh family, and this is not going to end well. If people may remember, there is actually a precedent for a Democratic president entering the last year of his first term with a not very good economy going on, giving permission for a Middle Eastern dictator to come to the United States for medical treatment. Somewhat controversially for people who know the region, but people didn't really pay that much attention to the decision, when it actually happened. That, of course, being the Shah of Iran in 1979, and that didn't really work out very well for Jimmy Carter or for the United States. And, given that not just Yemen, but other countries in the Arabian Peninsula as well, the United States has been very supportive of Saudi Arabian interests and the interests of the ruling family in Bahrain and the various other Gulf states where dictatorial regimes have been facing democracy movements.
Yeah, and they've been is continuing to be supportive of the Egyptian military as well.
Yes, and we'll talk about that next week, I'm sure.
Yeah.
All right. Then that takes us on to your continuing coverage of overhyped and underreported stories for this last year.
So what would you like to start with, overhyped?
Why don't you start with overhyped?
Anthony Weiner and his, Weiner.
You know, that other part of his body that you're
exactly
not supposed to mention on the radio.
Yeah, because let's face it, it just wasn't news. He actually didn't do anything illegal. He cheated on his wife. Which he's probably not the first. I'm going to go out on a real limb here. He's probably not the first congressman to do kind of inappropriate things within the context of a monogamous relationship while he was serving on Capitol Hill. And this story dominated the national political media for 2 weeks. It was ridiculous.
Yeah. My addition to the overhyped stories for national is Sarah Palin. Will she run for president? I think that was asked multiple times during the year, probably at least once a week by one pundit or another.
It still is, actually.
And it still is. And it's getting kind of late for her to make the decision. So I think the idea that she may eventually jump into the race is just ridiculous at this point.
Well, yeah, she was late for 6 months ago, but yes.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, the Republican presidential nomination contest has spawned a number of overhyped stories. First of all, every candidate that had any kind of momentum at some point for a week and a half and then became the next president of the United States, and there were like five or six of them now. First of all, Donald Trump, which is just overhyped, period, because he was never actually running for anything except for greater ratings for his TV show.
Yeah.
But after that, we had, We had Michelle Bachmann. We had Rick Perry. We had Newt Gingrich. Now we have Ron Paul. Santorum's got to be in the mix somewhere, no pun intended. And Dump. Some people will get that reference. Some people won't. It's just every time one of these people comes up, they get shot back down again, because this was the actual underreported story that we can get to in a minute here, is the fact that they're all nuts. You know, the mainstream media treats these people like they're serious folks who are qualified to have the most powerful job in the world, and they're not. The possible exception of Romney and Huntman, who have at least held elected office and not made fools of themselves while doing so. These folks, you can't even conceive of them holding that job. And mainstream media coverage simply did not acknowledge that in 2011, and probably won't in 2012 either. And then, of course, we have the usual cultural overhyped as well, Kim Kardashian's wedding and unwedding.
Anything about the Kardashians. I don't want to know.
Anything that appears on the front page in a supermarket checkout line, basically.
But what killed me about the news, the national news this year, is that anytime you turn on the TV, just ardent promotion of whatever else that station was going to be playing on the air as and talking it up as if it's news.
Yeah, that's been going on for several years now.
For a long time.
It's getting worse.
But it's getting far worse now.
Yeah. Yeah. The whole idea that news is a subdivision of the entertainment division has gotten a lot worse in the past few years.
Mm-hmm. All right. So that's the overhyped?
That's the overhyped.
And there's a lot of underreported, so let's get to it.
Yeah. So number one on my list of national underreported is when you have two opposing groups who can't agree and can't negotiate, and all they do is fight in your legislature, that's usually thought of as civil war. And that's really pretty much what Congress was this year.
Yeah. And of course, you know, the whole dynamic that Democrats continue to offer concessions that were just, you know, horrifying to their base, and Republicans would offer no concessions at all, and then it would become this one side's doing it, the other side's doing it kind of coverage.
Mm-hmm.
As though both sides were equally responsible for the obstruction, which really has not been true. So that was an underreported story. Climate change, once again, because the U.S. government isn't talking about it, because Congress isn't doing anything about it, climate change is pretty much off the radar of stories in 2011, even though violent, weather patterns are getting worse, even though we're continuing to have extreme weather events, droughts, all sorts of things that can be pretty directly traced to the effects of climate change, and even though the impact of climate change literally is threatening to the entire survival of the species, but for some reason it's not a priority, because it's not a priority of Republicans or Democrats in the United States.
Yeah, the next two on my list are kind of related. One is we talked earlier about how your free speech rights sort of equal how much money you have to spend. Well, this year, Occupy Wall Street really was the free speech fight that didn't have a lot of money to spend. And unfortunately, because of that, the media talked a lot about Occupy Wall Street demonstrators and mused a little bit about their goals and why they couldn't get their act together to run a candidate or something, but didn't talk a whole lot about what the Occupy Wall Street demonstrators were trying to say and the messages they were trying to get across.
Well, in fact, the criticism was that they didn't have a coherent message.
When in fact they did have coherent messages, many messages that the mainstream media doesn't cover, but the mainstream media couldn't actually get down on the street and talk to any of the folks to find out what those messages were.
Well, they could find out what they were, but they didn't want to repeat them.
No.
Yeah, and it then, seemed like they're as coherent as any of the Republican candidates running.
Much more coherent,
much
actually.
Much more coherent, I think. And then, of course, the other underreported story I had was the media kept saying, oh, the Tea Party was never this bad as these Occupy Wall Street demonstrators, when in fact the Tea Party was as bad.
Far worse, actually.
The media could not seem to remember the Arizona shooting of Gabrielle Giffords and how Jared Loughner was inspired by right-wing talk radio and the Tea Party. They couldn't remember the bomb that had been discovered in Spokane at the Martin Luther King Day March, which again the bomber himself was, in fact, claimed that he had been following the Tea Party and right-wing talk radio for quite a bit of time and was inspired by them.
Yeah, and he also had neo-Nazi connections.
Yes, and neo-Nazi connections. And there were many, many other examples of this as well, how the Tea Party movement inspired a lot more violence and a lot more extremism than the Occupy Wall Street demonstrators.
Yeah, and we saw, and of course, you know, and this might have been an overhyped story, you know, the whole idea that there's drug use around Occupy encampments and homeless people and sexual assault sometimes. Well, you know, in the downtown and central areas where these encampments tend to take place, there's a lot of that stuff going on the street every day, whether there's an encampment or not.
Yeah.
And so it was very easy to cherry pick these kind of incidents to depict Occupy activists as degenerates and as dirty hippies and you know, people that you don't want to associate with, which of course is a direct effort to undercut the whole "we are the 99%" message by saying, no, these people are not the mainstream. These people are the fringe, and you should not want anything to do with them.
Yeah. And then another of my underreported stories for National was the link between genetically modified crops, Roundup, and widespread crop failures in the Midwest. This was not reported at all. It is a huge problem, and it is not being addressed by the U.S. government, the EPA, anybody. Studies that showed infertility in livestock that were fed genetically modified crops, and that should raise huge questions about what we might be getting in our food supply.
Yeah. A couple of stories that were just came out this year, but were actually related to the economic downturn in 2008-2009. One was that the Fed loaned $7.77 trillion to big banks late in the Bush administration, early in the Obama administration. And because the Fed is a private bank and doesn't have to report that, they'd actually been very resistant for the past couple of years in telling even Congress, let alone the public, how much money had been lent. But we found out that they actually lent 10 times as much money as was involved in the TARP bailout. And for some reason, that story didn't get a whole lot of attention because it was old, basically. The other piece of that was that an awful lot of congressional insider trading went on around that collapse, and Congress people taking the knowledge that they had of getting, you know, from the briefings from Henry Paulson and then later Timothy Geithner and going and playing the stock market and hedging their investments and basically betting against the U.S. economy and making money off of that. And then there was even a
these are the people who are supposed to be trying to fix things. Remember?
These are people trying to fix things, and there was an effort this year to try and outlaw that practice. And that was shot down by Eric Cantor, the Republican House leader, who was one of the people who engaged in this trading. And that should have been a huge scandal, and it was not.
Yeah, I think they're fixing things. They just interpret it fixing different than you do.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Fixing in the same way say, a horse race.
Is that all of your National, or did you have more?
I probably have more National here. Sure.
Because my last national one kind of leads into international.
Well, mine does too, actually. The wealth gap, would be an underreported mm-hmm. one because, it is increased with the economic downturn so that it is now, a 20-to-1 gap between whites and African Americans. The average, or the median wealth for a Caucasian in the United States, now about $100,000, and that's all of your assets. That includes real property and the like. Whereas it's only about $5,000 for African Americans. That was a 12-to-1 ratio in 2008. That means the economic downturn has far more disproportionately affected people, African Americans and people of color. The unemployment rate also doubled for African Americans and up to 40% for young African Americans. And the whole idea that the economic downturn has hurt minority communities much more widespread manner than it has white just has not made it into media coverage at all.
Okay. So I'm going to start in on the international stories. Number one in my international list is the Fukushima Daiichi meltdown in three reactors.
Well, I have one that's a local going into international. So
okay. We're running a little short on time.
Yeah, the domestic use of drones, and I'll just leave it at that it's being used now for domestic law enforcement, for border enforcement and such. The same technology that's being used to assassinate and kill people and kill civilians in Pakistan and five or six other Muslim countries in the Middle East is now also being used on U.S. soil with virtually no oversight and no publicity.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the international ones, Fukushima, just this week, Japan admitted that it wasn't going to take 30 years to clean up. It was going to take 40 years or possibly more, and that it was going to require robots and other technology that hasn't even been invented yet. I think that's an underestimate of the problem at Fukushima. You had three nuclear plants that melted down. Completely melted down, and we still don't know how bad things are. Just a couple weeks ago, the water recycling system broke down because radiation had been leaking from it. There were cracks in the concrete containers for the radioactive water that was being cleaned and recycled to cool the plants. Literally, they are still just pouring water in on top of the fuel to try to keep it cool. And if it can erode the concrete tanks that quickly on the water recycling system, you know that the fuel that is melted through the first layer of containment into the concrete containers of these three melted down reactor cores, you know that it's probably melting through those as well and getting into the environment. So I think things at Fukushima are much, much worse than we've been led to believe. And I'm sick of the U.S. media accepting what the Japanese government says as the truth. Instead of talking to experts who know better.
Yeah, and we've heard this echo for decades from the nuclear industry of, we don't know how to deal with the nuclear waste, but that's a technology that hasn't been invented yet, but we'll fix it.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. On the top of my list for the international stories has been that the U.S. is withdrawing from Iraq, leaving a dictatorship. And we talked about this earlier in the show, but, the whole idea that we went in there to create a democracy and we're leaving with a dysfunctional dictatorship really hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention.
Yeah, yeah. And then I'll just talk about the next one on my list. The U.S. and Israel launched a terrorist attack on Iran this year, and it wasn't covered much in the media. It was called the Stuxnet worm. And the Stuxnet worm did a lot of damage to infrastructure, not just in Iran, but to infrastructure all over the world in places like India and Pakistan. And it was literally a U.S. cyber warfare, and it was not covered.
Yeah, and there was also a lot of non-coverage of Israel killing the peace process, setting up more settlements in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and making plans and making publicly making plans to unilaterally invade Iran. That whole hasn't been covered, and the U.S. support for dictatorial regimes in the Middle East during the Arab Spring not covered. The crushing of the Egyptian revolution, the U.S. indifference to the atrocities in Bahrain because our Fifth Fleet is stationed there, all that kind of support, very much soft-pedaled by the U.S. media or talking about, we have to strike a balance between promoting democracy and protecting U.S. interests.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, and it sounds like you guys got a lot more that will be...
No, just a little bit more. But we will be posting these on the Eat the State website. So I will also be writing up and posting the top financial stories that I talked about last week.
Yeah, all that stuff's going to go up hopefully by the end of the weekend.
All right. Events.
One event coming up this week, that is on Thursday, January 5th, 2012, at 6:30, excuse me, Palestinian activist Omar Barkoudi is going to be speaking on the BDS campaign, regarding Israel. That'll be at St. Mark's Cathedral, Bloedel Hall, 1245 10th Avenue on Capitol Hill. Again, Thursday at 6:30 p.m., free to all.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Joe Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
As Maria mentioned, all the overhyped and underreported stories are going to be going up on the Eat the State website in the next day or so. Check it out at www.eatthestate.org. And Happy New Year.